Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Helen Hill. The administrative law judge's decision and analysis contains several errors which require reversal by this Court. First, the ALJ's decision includes two significant errors of fact. In his credibility determination, the ALJ relied heavily on his finding that the plaintiff's primary problem was her poorly controlled diabetes, and he found that the diabetes was primarily poorly controlled because she failed to comply with her insulin requirements. But that fact is just false. The ALJ's finding is wrong on the record. There are approximately 27 references to blood sugar levels in this file. Only one time was Ms. Hill's blood sugar within the reference range or normal. Of the 26 times that it was not under good control, there's only four instances where there was evidence of noncompliance with her insulin requirements. So 22 out of the 26 times when her diabetes was found to be out of control or poorly controlled, the evidence does not indicate lack of compliance. Several times it specifically indicates she was in compliance.
Diabetes, is this a common symptom that doctors say it's what do they call it, poor control?
Yes.
Is that common in diabetes? There's just no way to control it? I'm really being anecdotal, but the people that I know that had diabetes or have it control it. But it takes a great deal of discipline and a constant attendance. It's not something you can just let go for a while.
Right. Well, and that's, I guess, our point is that this record doesn't indicate that the claimant let go or didn't take her insulin on a regular basis. Occasionally, because she ran out of her medications, or one time because she was very depressed. But one of the things about this record is that one doctor indicated that Ms. Hill had unusually high insulin requirements. So, and many times when her diabetes was poorly controlled, the doctors were increasing her medication. So you would think that if the doctors thought she was poorly controlled because she wasn't taking her medicine, then routinely the doctor's treatment notes would say she's got to start taking her medication. But that only happened four times throughout her entire treatment. Many times they increased her medication level, which suggests that the doctors were not able to control her diabetes. One thing I think in general in Social Security cases, often the people who file for benefits, who have conditions that often can be controlled, they're the ones whose conditions can't be controlled. And that's why even though they're getting treatment, they're not able to sustain work.
Is that because of money or what? Why aren't they able to sustain it?
Well, in this case, it was because she's one of the minority of people whose diabetes was not able to be controlled, despite the fact that most of the time she was in compliance with her medication.
So even under constant care, she'd still have the same problem.
That's the way this record reads, yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, the other thing, as far as the dual claim, one for disability and the other for supplemental security income, the disability eligibility ran out in, 2002?
Correct, the end of March.
And this assessment here is continuous through 2008 or 7 or something, for a long period of time after that, where the ALJ continually found her not eligible.
That's correct.
Are we looking at a possible split here, where she's past the time of disability, but perhaps eligible for supplemental?
Yes, absolutely. And some of this claimant's, her depression, as well as the problem with her left shoulder, the evidence is for those two impairments are primarily after the time that her insured status expired. But as you pointed out, for the supplemental security income aspect of her case, that doesn't matter. If she's disabled, she'd be entitled to the SSI benefits, but not the disability insurance benefit. Mm-hmm. The other primary factual error that the ALJ made was in finding that Ms. Hill could frequently reach in all directions. The evidence shows that the plaintiff has degenerative arthritis in the AC joint of the left shoulder. Several doctors said she had limited range of motion. Only one doctor actually tested that range of motion. And this is on what's called passive range of motion, which is where
there's other doctors, experts, who just review the court, rather. the hospital records?
Well, the doctors who reviewed the records, they didn't even, apparently they didn't even know about her arthritic shoulder. Their reports don't indicate that that was one of the impairments they were considering. And the ALJ actually rejected their residual functional capacity assessments. But the treating doctor indicated that the claimant has a flexion of only 70 degrees in the left shoulder, and flexion is moving the arm straight up this way with 180 degrees being overhead, and she had abduction of only 50 degrees, which would be maybe there. So with that type of limitation, this claimant, plaintiff could never raise her left arm over shoulder level, let alone above overhead, but the ALJ found that she could frequently reach overhead. I think this court's decision in the Golombuski versus Barnhart case, that's 322 F3rd 912, is on point. In that case, the claimant's doctor indicated she could only bend to 45 degrees, but the ALJ found that she could bend occasionally. This court found that the ALJ's finding was inconsistent with the doctor's opinion and range of motion findings, and reversed and remanded for consideration of that finding.
Have you taken into consideration her own problems, too? I mean, specifically her refusal to take insulin as prescribed?
Well, that's what I was indicating before. This record actually shows that on the majority of times, the vast majority of times in the record, she did take her insulin as prescribed.
I know, but does it? Do you take that into consideration?
If the record had showed that she was non-compliant on a regular basis, yes.
Well, what does the record show?
The record
concerning it, how many times that she did miss it?
There's four treatment notes indicating that she was non-compliant, and 22 treatment notes indicating that she was compliant.
And did the narcotic that she was taking interfere?
On this record, there's no evidence that the claimant continually used any narcotic drugs.
Not continually, but did she use them?
That was a past problem, not at the time of the ALJ's hearing or decision. It had been several years since the claimant had used any
narcotics. How long does that affect a person who is suffering from diabetes?
There's no evidence on this record that it affects the diabetes at all.
Right.
I would like to just point out a couple of other things, and that is that ALJs are not supposed to ignore an entire line of evidence. And in this case, the plaintiff testified to problems with fatigue. A Social Security analyst indicated that her combination of hepatitis, obesity, and diabetes made her complaints of fatigue credible. And yet the ALJ completely ignored the question of fatigue. He doesn't discuss it in his decision at all.
Well, didn't they say she was not credible because her not owning up to the drug use?
Well, that was one of the reasons that he found her not credible, but he didn't discuss the fatigue issue at all. He didn't find her not credible concerning the fatigue. He doesn't mention it. He also doesn't mention the problem that she had using her hands that she testified to and she complained to her doctors of. And Social Security ruling 96-8P under a section called Narrative Discussion Requirements states that the RFC assessment must include a discussion of why reported symptom-related limitations can or cannot reasonably be accepted as consistent with the medical and other evidence. So an ALJ may not merely ignore a claimant's alleged limitations when there's some medical evidence supporting them. In this case, concerning fatigue and the hand impairment, the ALJ completely ignored those impairments, and therefore his decision violated the requirements of the ruling.
Symptom-related, then, it appears to be her testimony. Is that what you would say? Symptom-related?
Well, her testimony, it was her testimony concerning the limitations. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So symptom-related. And the ALJ's discussion, according to the ruling, has to include a discussion of the alleged limitations if there's some support in the record, and in this case there is.
If this goes to something on SSI, would this have to go back to determine when that begins?
That's correct, yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Thomas for Michael J. S. Drew, the Commissioner of Social Security. I'd like to address the claim that there are two fact errors by the ALJ first. With respect to non-compliance from not taking insulin, the record does support this finding. My opponent's claim is that Ms. Hill suffers from some form of diabetes that's very severe and not controllable. But the record shows that she, in fact, often just didn't take it. In July of 2002, shortly after she was released from jail, she ran out of insulin, went to the hospital, was given insulin, and immediately discharged. Her doctors frequently mentioned that she wasn't exercising, that she wasn't controlling her weight, that she needed to improve diet and exercise in order to have control over her diabetes. There's one finding here from January of 2003 where she said that she was irregularly exercising and her doctor said she had good control. So I would submit that this is, as Your Honor was saying, a more typical form of diabetes where she just needed to exert control over it in order, diet and exercise in order to have control over her diabetes.
Well, it must have not been at a level where these lapses didn't put her into seizures.
Well, she went to the hospital several times in the record. I think we should distinguish between her regular treatment visits with her family doctor where she would get refills of insulin supplies and then incidents where she basically just wasn't taking it and then showed up at the hospital with a very high blood sugar level and they would give her fluid and insulin and then release her.
Wasn't she in fact frequently visiting hospitals?
Your Honor,
emergency rooms?
I would say that there's a pattern, certainly that she was regularly visiting hospitals, maybe not frequently, but certainly the record shows that she would go see her family. She certainly had ongoing medical treatment. She would go to the doctor, her own doctor, for a while and pick up her supplies, get her needles, but then every once in a while she would just not take it and then have to go to the hospital to get treated. But I don't think, I would disagree with my opponent's characterization of the record. I don't think it shows that her diabetes was all uncontrollable. It just showed that she wasn't particularly good at maintaining the discipline necessary to control it.
Is this strictly a credibility issue? Because when I look at her brief and geez, everything else in here, it doesn't look like she could do anything.
Based on her?
Your Honor,
I believe the ALJ's credibility assessment is a big part of the finding.
And who would hire her, even in these sedentary jobs or whatever they are? I don't know where we draw the line. Maybe it's all down to credibility. If the IJ doesn't believe her, the ALJ doesn't believe her and doesn't give her credibility and says she's gold brick and that all this stuff, she just doesn't want to do anything. But I don't know where we are, but everything I look at, it's just this woman's pretty much, someone would say, a basket case.
Your Honor, I think what the ALJ did was say, I have a hard time believing her claimed severity of her symptoms. And I think the ALJ gave pretty good reasons for why he doubted her credibility. She lied a lot, quite frankly. She lied about her history of drug use. I believe at one point there was mention of the fact that no one ever said anything about the interaction between her past drug use and her diabetes. Well, the reason for that is she lied to her doctors about her past drug use. When they asked, you know, she said she told them she hadn't used drugs for, I believe, 18 years, and it had been 3. So perhaps a doctor would have said something differently had they known the truth. But yeah, I believe the credibility here is a big part of the ALJ's decision. But also, the second fact error my opponent claims is that with respect to her overhead reaching, it's also a matter of lack of evidence. Ms. Hill is trying to paint this as an articulation problem, that the ALJ ignored a line of evidence. This isn't true. There is no evidence. There's no evidence of there's one range of motion finding, a passive range of motion finding. The problem is her treating physicians provided no restrictions based on one range of motion finding. The state agency physicians who did review the record thought she could do medium work with no restrictions. And while my opponent speculates that they didn't have access to this information, there's no reason to think that from the record. They reviewed these records after she had her range of motion finding. So they were aware. We have no reason to think they weren't aware of it.
ALJ didn't discuss her inability to use her hands fully, did he?
No, Your Honor. I believe with respect to her manual limitations, there's no medical evidence. Again, it's a limited assertion she made, a subjective complaint. And what we have here is that she mentions tingling in her hands 3 times in the record. 2 of those 3 times occur after she failed to comply with taking her medication. And obviously with diabetes, there are neuropathic symptoms that occur when you know, in the more severe symptoms of the disease. If you're not compliant, you're going to have tingling and circulation problems. two out of the three mentions here occur right after time she didn't comply with her medication. So, again, and then the last mention is in October of 2005, and it drops out of the record.
How about her depression? Did the ALJ treat that?
Your Honor, the ALJ mentioned that, well, what the ALJ mentioned was she didn't allege any limitations arising from depression. She had an attorney at the hearing. They had the ability.
Mentioned in the medical records, though, right?
What they mentioned, there are three mentions, Your Honor, in the medical record of her mentioning depression to her doctor, and her doctor saying, okay, here are some antidepressants. That's it.
What does the record reveal about her, the relationship, if any, between her depression and her failure to take her medication?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I believe it. I'm sure it's possible that
Does the record really ever tell us why she didn't take the medication?
No. I believe there's one time in September of 2005 where she admitted that she hadn't taken her medication for 3 months.
And she also said she couldn't buy it, but at the same time she was buying narcotics. Is that right?
No. Her drug use, at least from the record, ended, I believe, in 2000. Well, she was arrested in 2001 and got out of jail in 2002. So we have nothing in the record from after she got out of jail in 2002 to suggest she was buying drugs.
Pardon me?
We have nothing in the record from after 2002 to suggest that she was buying illegal drugs.
No, but was she buying them at the same time when the events were that she alleges she was not able to buy insulin?
Well, Your Honor, no, because I believe the record shows that she had steady, regular access to medical care, and a lot of it comes from a clinic in Milwaukee that was free, and she was able to come in and get her needles and her medication. I don't think that argument holds weight.
Going back to the arthritis for a moment, the ibuprofen she was taking, that was a prescription strength, was it not?
I'm actually not sure, Your Honor. I know the ALJ mentioned that she was taking ibuprofen, but in any event, for someone to have the disabling severity of pain that she alleged...
It would be a problem if he was under a misapprehension as to whether she was taking prescription medication or not. He seemed to feel she was not, and yet the record does seem to show that it was a prescription strength.
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't say, the best of my knowledge, the ALJ doesn't say over-the-counter medication. I mean, he says ibuprofen with a capital I. I believe there's no reason to assume that he mistakenly understood this to be over-the-counter medication. And I would submit, even at a prescription dosage of ibuprofen is like three or four of them out of the over-counter bottle. It still doesn't suggest a level of pain that would be disabling or severely affect her functional abilities.
Of course, sometimes physicians prescribe the ibuprofen and nothing, prescription strength and nothing stronger, because there are other reasons why a patient can't tolerate anything else, right?
Not in this record, but yes, Your Honor, that does occur. I think here with the arthritis, she mentions it three times. Three times, and it drops out of the record. You know, the first complaint of shoulder pain is in October 2003. She mentions it. Her doctor referred her for physical therapy. She never went. And then it drops out of the record. She never complained about her shoulder again, and she never complained about it at the hearing.
The ALJ referred to her frequency of urination problem as episodic.
Yes.
Well, even if it was episodic, wouldn't it have a terrific effect on her ability to do a job?
Well, again, I think this comes down to credibility. I mean, Ms. Hill said she had to go to the bathroom every 5 minutes. The ALJ reasonably said, I don't know what to do with that. That's a ridiculous frequency. There's no reason to think, even I think they conceded the ALJ didn't have to believe that. The thing is, it's based on her claim of uncontrolled diabetes, but this again connects to the part of the ALJ's decision where he discusses the fact that she chose not to control her diabetes. And the ALJ's finding was simply that, you know, these are jobs that have a sit-down option, you know, general clerk. He was saying these are the kind of jobs where you probably can go to the bathroom on a normal basis.
Did he ever take into consideration her fatigue factor?
Fatigue, again, Ms. Hill paints this as an articulation problem. The ALJ didn't address it because there's no evidence of it. And I would argue that the ALJ did in part address it because he limited her to light rather than medium work and provided a sit-stand option. So, again, and then with respect to her claim that there was an agency claims analyst who found her claims of fatigue credible, She omits reference to the fact that that same person also said that that Ms. Hill could do medium work, which is a lot. That's, you know, a significant exertion. And similarly, state agency physicians thought she could do medium work. Her doctors didn't limit her based on fatigue or any of her other impairments. They said, hey, increase your level of exercise, increase your level of activity. So there's very little evidence in here that the ALJ could have used to find anything based on fatigue. I can see my time's up. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you some time.
Just a couple of points. At page 25 of the record, 28 of the appellant's appendix, the ALJ specifically states, as Your Honor pointed out, that the claimant was not taking any prescription pain medication, but yet the record shows she was prescribed prescription strength ibuprofen. The commissioner analyzes the record and tries to explain to this court why the ALJ could have found that the claimant's fatigue was not limiting or that her hand problems were not limiting. The problem for this court is that it's the ALJ's responsibility to analyze the evidence in the first instance. In the Golden-Bluski case and Steele versus Barnhart, this court has followed the Chenery, you know, requirement for administrative law that the court's not supposed to rely on facts or theories that the ALJ himself didn't rely on to affirm the ALJ's decision. So all of these discussions about whether or not the fatigue was disabling or not, the ALJ at least had to mention it and discuss the evidence, and he did not, and that should require reversal. In terms of depression, the ALJ, I didn't mention this, so Your Honor brought it up, the depression, the ALJ found that the claimant's depression was a severe impairment. But after finding it to be a severe impairment, there's then no other discussion as to, well, what limitations were caused by this problem, which he, in fact, found to be severe. The ALJ should have discussed that also. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Counsel. The court will take the case under advisement. The court is adjourned until tomorrow morning.